All right. Well, we should be live here. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. We are continuing our monthly live Q&A series with our financial advisory partners. We did the last one not all that long ago. Our schedule got a little bit disrupted given the Wealthion conference that we just produced. So we are trying to get back on the schedule. Our plan is to try to do this in the first week of every month going forward. So we'll do that when we can. And obviously, if something happens in the markets, we'll do an emergency one of these to let you guys ask questions. I'm joined, as usual, by the lead partners at New Harbor Financial. Looks like we're also being graced today with the presence of Lance Roberts from RIA. We've had his colleague, Mike Leibowitz, sitting in for him the past couple of times, but we've got Lance back. So let me bring everybody up here. Let's see here. I can still remember how to do this. Hey, Lance. Hey, Mike. Hey, John.
Hello, Adam. Hello, everybody. It's good to be back.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having us again. This is great.
Yeah, folks really seem to like this format. And folks, this will be made available as a replay video as soon as this video is over. So if you can't watch the whole thing, don't worry. Just come back to our YouTube channel. You'll be able to watch the whole replay video. And if you're watching this on replay, good to see you. There's a live chat going on here, though, in the live recording here. So folks, as you have questions, please ask them in that live chat. I will be surfacing them as best I can for our panel of experts here to take swings at. I also just want to let folks know, too, we're going to have to keep this one contained to about an hour. We usually are a little bit more open-ended. But as Lance had a daughter the other week who turned 16, mine just turned 16, and she is taking her driver's license exam in about an hour and a half. And so she's made me promise that I got to get out in time to be able to get her to take her test. All right. So with that being said, guys, there has been a lot of discussion over the past 48 hours of, hey, is the bottom in? Did we just see the bottom? Prices, as both of you have been saying, had been getting kind of oversold in the near term as we went into the end of Q3 and all the portfolio rebalancing and stuff that gets done then. Then we had the Bank of England, desperate rescue last week. And a lot of people began thinking, hey, maybe that means the Fed's going to have to pivot sooner rather than later. And we saw an amazing rally over Monday and Tuesday of this week. I think the S&P was up more than 6% in 48 hours. We're seeing things cool off again today. But the big question out there is this bounce we've just seen, is that a bounce off the bottom? Or is this just yet another, bear market, get their hopes up, then yank the rug away from them? John, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, thank you, Adam, and thank you all for finding some time to join us today, whether it's lunch hour or some other time of your day. We continue to believe that what we're in is likely a new secular bear market. And like most bear markets, if history's any guide, this bear market, if that's in fact what we're in, is likely to be punctuated by several drops followed by sometimes very sharp and face-ripping rebounds, oftentimes to lower highs, only to turn around and drop to new, even more modest lows than were previously achieved. So we think what we have seen here in the last couple of days, and today the market's off a bit, is just a confluence of some pretty oversold conditions with some market reading into some central bank pivoting. Doesn't hurt that it was the beginning of the month where you get the automatic fund flows from things like 401k contributions and things like that. But we think even if this market has some legs to the upside in the short term, we're likely to see it repeal again, like it has three or four times already this year, to reach successive new lows. So I'll just pause there. I think that's the broad picture we see here.
All right. Lance, let's get RIA's opinion on this.
No, really not much different. Again, we kind of always do this. It's kind of always like we just all agree. So, look, Mark, I wrote an article last Tuesday called, the big short squeeze is coming. And the whole premise of that was the fact that, you know, look, you had record bearish sentiment, record put options, you know, outstanding on markets, you know, a lot of these issues, which is always kind of that setup for a nice counter trend rally, right? Rally. So you have all these shorts out there. They, when they start to have to get, you know, forced to cover, you're going to get a rally. Markets are deeply oversold short term, and MACDs are at very low levels. So again, from a technical basis, you've got a good setup for a rally. But again, as we've been saying for the last couple of weeks, really last month, I guess, is, you know, want to use rallies to sell into and raise cash. You know, we're putting on a few little trading positions here and there to our portfolio just to, you know, to look for a tradable bounce. But then we're going to sell that, reduce exposure further, and raise some more cash.
Okay. So, Mike, let me come to you here. Are you guys doing the same, which is basically looking at this short-term rally here, especially if it still continues to have some legs, as a way to help clients unload longs that they, you know, can get out of at a better price? Also, are you planning on any sort of tactical trades like Lance's in terms of trying to catch a little bit of the bounce here?
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit that we're a little bit slower moving sometimes. We are looking for tactical long trades, but we're just not seeing our target zones being hit. Somewhere in the 3550 to 3600 range, you know, we were looking at a tactical long. Of course, we've seen this very, very rapid bounce the last couple of days. So it's a little bit faster than we expected. And by the way, roughly 3% days in succession is pretty rare. In fact, so rare that in general, it only happens during bear markets. It could be, you know, the sign of a kickoff to a new bull market. Nobody knows for sure, but almost always these types of moves happen in the context of bear markets. Ultimately, looking at the charts, we see the markets getting down to the 3,200 to 3,400 range. So we don't want to be too quick to act. Absolutely, we're looking for tactical trades, but really looking for something below 3,600 to even start to nibble. And even there, it'll be in a hedged fashion, something that's paired with options to capture premium, and something that will allow us to hopefully make money even if we're early. Because that's the real fear here. The real risk is being early, buying the dip. This market has been nothing if not resilient to bouncing off every single technical level to the upside. You know, almost every, you know, bullish support zone has worked for years and years and years. We think that's going to stop working, and we're going to get an elevated drop that's going to be surprising, and that could be coming very soon. So the last couple of days, absolutely, we did urge people that had stocks that they wanted to sell that this is a good point to lighten up. But the market basically just touched the June lows for about a day and a half. The NASDAQ, the S&P, the Dow, they all broke their June lows for about 2 days maximum and then rocketed from there. The Russell 2000 did not break the June lows. So, you know, we continue to be patient, lightening up into strength and looking to do some tactical longs, but again, a little bit, looking for a little bit better levels to start layering in, because we think the real likelihood is that we're going to have to layer in over a couple steps. Again, looking at that broad range of 3,200 to 3,400, we don't actually think that that will be the ultimate bottom of the market. We think that we've entered, as John said, a secular bear market, and we'll probably see waves lower and lower over the next year or so. And I don't think we've even seen the first real drop yet, and that should be down into the low 3,000s on the S&P.
Okay, great. I got a lot of questions here. I'm going to try to wrap into some sort of quasi-linear progression, but let me start with a really specific question, which is, as we've seen prices bounce hard on Monday, Tuesday, cooling off a bit now, we saw bond yields come down pretty substantially. And there's some questioning here. Is that because central banks are in there buying bonds? I mean, we know that the Bank of England was in the bond market in the UK buying bonds last week to stem the possible contagion that was happening there. Do you guys see central banks as stepping in to intervene here beyond just what's happening in the UK? Lance, let's start with you.
Yes, there's going to be, look, again, we go back, this is a dollar story at the end of the day, right? And the stronger the dollar gets, the more capital flows get attracted to U.S. dollars. And there's actually been a good bit of bond buying at the end of the day. If you actually look at bond inflows, they've actually been doing fairly well. So, you know, we're definitely seeing bond yields come down here a bit, not surprising. But again, this has been a very highly correlated market over the course of the last year. stocks go down, bonds go down, stocks go up, bonds go up. You know, it's been just, you know, just a very high correlation of assets. And that's not usually the case. That's made it very difficult to manage money, particularly if you're kind of, your hedge has historically been going into to treasuries as a risk off hedge. That hasn't worked this year very well. You know, again, but, you know, there's going to be an issue going forward. There is, you know, as the Fed continues to hike rates, they're going to wind up breaking something. And then when something breaks, the safest place to be at that point will be treasury bonds. And it's just something that, that hasn't happened yet. But if, you know, we do have that break in the market of some sort, you know, you're going to see lower stock prices and higher bond prices. They'll start to negatively diverge.
Okay. And let's talk for a second about that something breaking. So we saw last week something break over in the UK. I alluded to that earlier for folks that have maybe been under a rock because of some conflicting policy in the UK. The UK bond market, or their bonds are called gilts there, yields just started shooting the moon, and it threatened to basically bring down the entire pension system as well as other players inside the UK. And so the Bank of England had to abandon its imminent plans to do quantitative tightening and step in and inject, I think initially about $65 billion worth of, or pounds worth of buying into the market to buy bonds to stop the rise in yields. I think that number has now been bumped up to about £100 billion worth. So that is a clear example of a central bank that that had an agenda, and it had to pivot from that. It was forced to pivot from that agenda by something breaking on the ground. Of course, the key question that folks are asking is okay, well, then is that a preview of a movie, you know, that we're going to see on our shores here in the U.S. or in other, you know, major economies? And does it also mean that because something's breaking there, that the timeline is getting accelerated, and that something, if it's going to break here, is probably going to break sooner rather than later? John, why don't we give you that question, and feel free to add on to anything that Lance said earlier too, if you like.
Yeah, it's real hard to say, Adam. You know, just today, for example, we got some jobs numbers that I think were stronger than expected. These are things that are not helpful to the case, either for the Fed or market participants trying to forecast the Fed's moves in terms of talking down or coming off their hard line on interest rate increases. I think, and the bond market did rally pretty strongly first couple days this week with stocks. And Lance is exactly right; they've been highly correlated because both trades have been, you know, a game theory on what the Fed will or will not do. You know, if they end up pivoting and coming off their hard line, everything rallies, right? The opposite is the case if they stay strong on rate increases. I think there's a lot of breakage that, first of all, I think we'll find out that, you know, for example, our banks are way better capitalized than they were in the housing crisis of 2008-09. Doesn't mean they're not subject to contagion, but you know, I think as compared to, for example, some of the European banks, Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank and UBS now, the credit default swaps futures on those banks have shot through the roof, you know, basically market implied, you know, reading into some really troubling developments there. And that's what I think is a bit of a conundrum here or bafflement. You know, a lot of folks went into the weekend thinking there was going to be some really bad news coming out with respect to Credit Suisse, and I think most market participants were prepped for a kind of very weak opening on Monday in response to that, and we had quite the opposite. And whether there was some intervention there, or, you know, we don't know until after the fact, and we never know really what central banks are doing in their open market operations in that kind of sense. But I think the short, you know, short positioning combined with the oversold sentiment gave an explosive rally there on the, you know, perhaps the reading into the good news that Credit Suisse didn't blow up like many people thought it was on the verge of doing. Here today, the bonds are selling off a bit already. So I think this, you know, it's too hard to say. We're not in the business of making day by day calls here by any stretch. But I think we're going to see that this knee-jerk move higher in markets and bonds the last couple of days, probably is going to be fairly short-lived. And I think the inflation picture is still going to be very intractable problem for our central bank to tackle here, and they're going to be very careful to pivot too soon, I think.
Okay, you talked about three things there: inflation, the risk of the banking system, and the pivot. I want to talk about each one of those things. Maybe real quick, Mike, just coming to you because I'm seeing a lot of chatter about it here in the live chat. Gold has, the precious metals have shown some life over the past couple of days. Silver, I think, had a ferocious day on Monday. It was up like over 8%, I think. So could we be at the part of the story where, going back to the UK, it's unclear at this point whether the UK is going to be able to continue its inflation fighting policy, right? It basically got to the point where, it said, look, we're serious about going after inflation. We've been hiking rates. Now we're going to start quantitative tightening. And then something broke and it had to, go back to easing immediately. So it's very unclear that they are going to be able to continue fighting inflation because their system otherwise just might melt down. So I assume that's got to give a little bit of support to the precious metals, because people are saying, okay, look, it looks like inflation might be around a lot longer if their central banks really can't fight it. So curious, what's your general, I know you guys have been, gold is a key sort of foundational part of your general portfolio. Has your outlook evolved at all in the past couple of days based on what I just mentioned?
Oh, not at all, Adam. Gold and silver is indeed a foundational part of what we recommend. We think that just about everybody should have 5 or 10% of their assets in physical gold and or silver, and 5 or 10% of their investable assets, not 5% of their total assets, including real estate necessarily. But gold has held that line at 1680 or so for a long time, several times over the last year or so. It's bounced off 1680. And then last week or the week before, it broke through there to the low 1600s. And it looked like, oh my goodness, it's a breakdown. It's a failure. And the sentiment got really bad on gold and silver. And the mining stocks just got pummeled. GDX went down to the low 20s, I think 21 or so. I think, and then just kind of reversed and rocketed from there. Silver had an excellent day yesterday, a really good day. Gold had a great day too last few days, and yes, it does seem like all assets bounced in a big way the last few days. But gold and silver are very attractive to us here. Gold held that line at 1680 because it overtook it quickly, and it's trading in the low 1700s around 1720 right now. And from a technical basis, it's broken the downtrend and to us looks ready to just take off to the upside. I'm not sure what's going to cause it, and maybe it's just the fact that for 20 years, central banks have meddled in absolutely everything. They've created all this instability that we're talking about. It's no accident that you're starting to see stresses in the financial system. The timing has been incredibly difficult to pin down. But central banks have just literally gotten their way. They've kicked the can for 20 years, actually more than 20 years, with no consequence. And, now we're seeing daily volatility in the equity markets that's just not normal. We're seeing huge swings up and down, the last couple of days up. And volatility is not your friend. Volatility is the sign of the system becoming more and more unstable. And yet, a lot of people are still not that concerned. I think people are starting to wake up a little bit to the environment, that the environment is risky. It seems to be more volatile. Something doesn't feel right. But the equity markets, with their close to 20, almost 25% pullback in the S&P before this recent bounce, they're just barely touching 1999, 2000 highs, the most egregious bubble we ever saw before this one. We're just back to that level. If you look at the most reliable indicators of valuation, things like price to sales, or market cap to GDP or the Shiller PE ratio, we're just back to the top of the previous bubble. So we believe volatility is going to stay for quite a while here, and that there's major risks to the downside. Gold and silver are real money. They give you a way to at least get part of your assets out of the banking system, and wouldn't be surprised to see gold reach maybe 2,500 sometime next year.
Okay. And I imagine, you know, part of the, what's going to happen with the gold story is one or two folks are reminding us here is what happens with the dollar, right? You know, if we get a dollar blow off top, probably going to keep a lid on gold for a bit. But if the dollar, you know, has a retracement, which even dollar milkshake theory developer Brent Johnson said, hey, in the near term, that could totally happen. You know, that could be good for the precious metals there. All right, Lance, I'm coming to you, and I've got two questions that then I want the New Harbor guys to react to as well. So their question asked here about Credit Suisse. You know, in the news right now, it's looking like Credit Suisse, maybe even Deutsche Bank, are struggling. But there's a lot of chatter that, you know, Credit Suisse's credit default securities are the highest they've been priced since the back of the global financial crisis. And there's some concern that that bank could go down. Their question is how significant would that be? Would that be a Lehman type moment? Is it that substantial a player, or is this just more, you know, a bank that got itself in trouble, and whether it gets dismantled or limps along or whatever, it's not important enough to bring the entire system down in the way that Lehman triggered?
Well, first of all, that's great bear porn, by the way. Yeah, CDSs are up to like 12%, whatever. You know, they're definitely up from the lows. And so that's certainly a concern. It's like, oh my gosh, your credit default swaps are certainly picking up. And that's what you would expect from, you know, a bank that's been involved in, you know, one kind of debacle after another. Remember, Credit Suisse was right at the heart of the whole blow up of Archipelago and, you know, funds, you know, that went on. So, you know, Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, these banks have been, you know, kind of on the risk of that verge of, you know, the storyline for a while. You know, UBS got crushed a couple of years ago. So, you know, the one lesson that was learned from the financial crisis is that nobody's letting a bank go bankrupt, right? So Credit Suisse can get themselves definitely in trouble, but they'll get bailed out by the EU. The Fed will bail out a domestic bank. Nobody's going to let another Lehman moment happen. So out of the list of concerns, that's not on the top of my list.
Okay. All right. Hopefully a relief for a lot of folks hearing, but you're right. I mean, if 2008 taught us anything, in addition to just bad actors and Wall Street can basically get away with the problems that they create and still pay themselves record bonuses. But from a policy side, it's don't let a big bank go down. So that makes a lot of sense. All right. So here's the other question. And New Harbor guys, I'll want you to weigh in on this too. You know, Lance, I think it was you who said in one of our recent weekly market recaps is basically, you know, the bullish case kind of just rests on a pivot, right?
Right.
I mean, there's not a lot of fundamental reasons. And even recently, there weren't a lot of technical reasons left to be bullish either. But now it seems the bullish case is just, hey, enough financial instability is going to happen at some point that the Fed is going to be forced to pivot. Now, of course, you know, that's almost kind of an oxymoron type statement because, you know, if things are really bad, that's not really a bullish case for stocks, you know, in and of itself. But the thinking is, hey, the Fed will pivot and then all asset prices are going to go back up again. And my question is, what are the odds of it happening that way? Or maybe the question is could those folks that are really hoping for a pivot, even if they get it, could they be disappointed? Might it not play out the way that they expect? One, because as you and I've talked about, there's a lot of Fed tightening that's happened that still is going to be sort of arriving for a good period of time because of the delay between policy actions and when the implications manifest. And also, I had a conversation video we launched yesterday where I interviewed Pedro da Costa, who has spent the past couple decades covering the Fed and talking to Fed policymakers. And he thinks that QE as a stimulative tool is off the table. You know, yeah, maybe they'll step in and do QE as a short-term lending facility to help truly, you know, vulnerable players from going out of business tomorrow. But this kind of return to tens of billions or 100 plus billion of monthly asset purchases, he thinks that the Fed policymakers have said, you know what, that turned out to be more trouble than it's worth. We're not going to do that again. So could we actually have a pivot and not have the party that the bulls are hoping for?
Sure. Anything's possible, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, we're talking about a, you know, a policy structure that's been put into place for the last 12 years, and it's now the playbook. So, you know, just like we started doing checks to households in 2020, next big downturn, it won't matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats or who controls Congress, it'll be checks to households, because that's now a new part of the playbook, because it works. It makes people, it makes asset prices go up, makes the economy go up. And so, you know, there's been a lot of talk for a long time that, you know, the Fed is going to stop doing QE, but they never do. That's their first policy tool they come back to. But step back to your earlier point, which is, look, markets are going to rally. We're deeply oversold here, right? We're deeply oversold. Sentiment is as negative as it was back in 2008. It's negative as it was back in at the June lows when we had that 17% rally. So you've got all the fuel you need for a good counter trend rally. And so the talk of a pivot is certainly going to get the bulls kind of excited short term. And so you get this kind of a pickup in asset prices. But if the Fed actually pivots, they're not going to be pivoting because everything's fine. They're not rates and or doing QE if they do it or not. They're not going to do that unless something is broken in the economy. And that's not going to be good for stocks. That's going to be the point of realization to where markets are repricing valuations and earnings to much lower levels. So that's going to be a deep recession. It'll be a credit crisis, margin calls, whatever it is. But that'll be the point the Fed starts converting, right? And starts reverting back to doing monetary accommodation. So that's not when they make that initial pivot, that's not the point you want to buy. It's going to be when rates start approaching back to zero, and that'll happen very quickly. It'll go from 4% to zero fairly fast. And when you get back towards that kind of, you know, the zero bound on interest rates, that should be theoretically about the point where you've got the mass devastation going on in the markets, where markets have now repriced for whatever's occurred in the market or the economy.
Okay. So just to restate a little bit what you've said, you know, when the pivot happens, that's really not the time to buy equities. And I know we're talking with big, big, broad brushstrokes here. That said, I think in the last time we talked, you said that will be the time when they announce it, that likely will be the time when bonds react, especially long-dated U.S. Treasuries. And to your point, you want to be in those things before the announcement comes out. Is that still true?
Yeah, no. We actually had this conversation the other day in my office, and I said, look, if clients would just sit still and let me do what I needed to do, I'd be 100% U.S. Treasury, long-dated U.S. Treasuries right now. I'd have 100% of my portfolio in long-dated Treasuries, and I would just sit on them because I'm going to get paid in the meantime for sitting on them and get a nice yield. But when the Fed pivots and when the realization is that you either have a recession, economic downturn, or something breaks, yields are going to grow 60-70% side roughly in TLT or in long-dated treasuries. At that point, there's no more gain to get out of bonds, right? You will have maximized the value of your treasuries. Now, in the process of that happening, corporate bonds are going to get blown out. They're going to, you know, yields will go up on corporate bonds over concerns of default risk, et cetera. So when yields approach zero, you've got maximum capital gains in treasuries. Sell all your treasuries, then start buying distressed, good quality company, corporate bonds, you know, preferred stocks will be really cheap, and, you know, buy discounted equities, and then switch your portfolio more towards, you know, go from a 60-40 allocation to an 80-20 allocation with equities and dividends. And then, you know, the next bear market will be your tailwind. Unfortunately, clients just don't deal well with that kind of a strategy.
All right. Well, it does kind of go against patience, the diversification.
Patience is a problem.
Yeah. And it goes a little bit against your gardening of, hey, let's just grow this all crop, you know, right now. All right. So John, let me hand the football back to you to see what you guys would add to that in terms of, anything you want to react to, but in particular, the hopes that so much of the market is placing on a pivot right now, that playbook may not play out the way they expect.
Yeah, I think, Well, again, it's been a game of chicken, I think, with the, between the market and central banks. And so far, the central banks have been, at least our central bank, has been pretty resolute in saying, hey, we're not even close to being done yet. Because they realize that this inflation is an intractable problem as it exists right now. And markets really haven't fell that much. I mean, we're barely, you know, if you look at where we are now, the valuations on the metrics that matter. I'm not talking about forward price to earnings ratios, which are notoriously horrible and whippy numbers to use, because first of all, forward analyst projections are notoriously off the mark. But if you look at things like margin adjusted, cyclically adjusted PE ratios, we're at valuations right now, even with the weakness in the market this year, that have only been seen before two times in history. The tech bubble, the very tippity top of the tech bubble, and 1929 before the Great Depression. Yeah, the last year has been higher than it is now, but that's you know, what we consider to be the biggest bubble of all time, fueled by the just the massive amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus out of the COVID sell-off. So I think we only need to look back to a couple of instances. Look at the tech bubble and the housing bubble. When those markets started to go down, the Fed panicked and started aggressively lowering interest rates after their raising of interest rates, which popped those bubbles. You know, we are in this vicious cycle of the Fed having very low interest rates, fueling bubbles, and then they try to come to the rescue and cleaning up the mess by lowering interest rates, but it's too late at that point because the bubbles are deflating. So both the tech bubble and the housing bubble, the Fed was aggressively lowering interest rates, yet it didn't stop those markets from plummeting over 50% in each case. In the tech bubble, tech stocks dropped over 80%. So even if there is a pivot, that doesn't mean assets are levitated, because at that point, the psychology of the market and the panic and the desire for safety outweighs the belief that the Fed has a put that will save everybody. And just one more little comment on Credit Suisse. You know, I did say, you know, because of the policies that have been done over the last bunch of years, including the current status of the Fed paying out $300 billion annually to banks in the form of interest and excess reserves, about $100 billion more than they take in on the bond interest payments they get on their portfolios. Our U.S. banks are better capitalized than they were in 2008-09. It doesn't mean they're getting immune from contagion, but I think the isolated Credit Suisses and things like that, I think we're likely to see, given where we are in the inflation battle, not a massive bailout of banks, but, you know, a shameful taking to the cleaners of those banks that are imminently against the ropes. Sheila Bair, David Stockman, a lot of folks have talked about all the bailouts that happened in 2008-09 were not necessary. That was basically a bailout of the system that didn't have, you know, the bondholders of those institutions, the stockholders of those institutions should have bore the losses, not the taxpayers. And there's systems in place, including the Fed discount window, in an organized fashion, liquidate and take over banks that run into trouble. So I don't think we're going to see a broad bailout and contagion like we did during that time. But then again, what the heck do I know? The system's very opaque, and we've seen where the incentives are amongst policymakers.
Yeah, and I've been hearing more talk about that lately from the folks, you know, that I've been interviewing, Lacey Hunt, Daniel DiMartino Booth, Pedro, as I mentioned, that, you know, it might not just be the blank check, get out of jail free card that, Wall Street and the big financial players got last time. We'll see. I do think that there's, you know, probably a lot behind what Lance said, though, is that they're probably just not going to let, you know, a bank go belly up. They might make the process more public, more shameful, more drawn out, not let the bank pay itself record bonuses in the process, that type of stuff. And I think we all would cheer that. All right, Mike, I'm going to come to you with this next question, which is from Farhad. There's several questions sort of around this, around 401ks and what folks should be doing right now. when folks have a 401k through work, they generally only have a couple of options that they're allowed to invest in. Sounds like Farhad here isn't thrilled about any of the ones he currently has. Seems like they're losing money, and not, no surprise in a year when stocks and bonds are down by as much as they are. What type of advice, I guess, would you give to somebody in a 401k plan right now? You know, would you advise they try to see if they can just get to cash inside the plan? And also, if you can talk about the, I think it's called the brokerage option that 401k plans offer too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a tough year for passive investors, and most investors in 401ks are passive investors. They pick an allocation, they set it, and they don't look at it if you know, other than maybe once in a while, once a year, once a quarter, something like that. And you're right, bonds are down this year quite a bit. I believe long-term bonds, if you look at TLT, is down over 30%. And the S&P before the bounce the other day was down 25%, something more like 20% now. So with stocks down 20% and bonds down 30%, almost everybody is going to be down unless you are sitting in cash or some type of alternative investment. And the problem with 401ks is they don't really offer much in terms of alternatives. So I do think it depends a little bit on where you are in life. If you're just starting work and you only have a little bit of money in there, you don't have to worry about this much. But the truth is, most of the people we talk to are not in that category. Most of the people we talk to, and by far the lion's share of the assets in this country, are, you know, with people that are 50 or 55 years and older that have concentrations in a 401k that might be the vast majority or all of their net worth, you know, particularly if they don't own a home. And even if you're younger, in your 30s and 40s, you probably have amassed a significant enough amount of money that you don't want to see it dwindle. So it's a little bit of a tough spot right here because a lot of people are down on the year, and we have a market that's maybe 20% off of its high, but could very likely and probably will go lower in the coming months and in year or so. If particularly if history is any guide and if math is any guide, like John just pointed out again, valuations are still just back to the tippity top of the previous two largest bubbles of all time. You know, the tech bubble peak in 2000, and you know the just before the Great Depression in September, October 1929. And combine that with the fact that it's all about the Fed and only about the Fed. Almost all of what people on financial news talk about is the Fed, because literally that's all that's mattered. They've created these great bubbles in busts. And frankly, I think that we're at the precipice of the third and largest bust of the last 25 years or so. So you've got to take a look at your 401k allocations and take some action if you're overexposed. If you're 100% stocks, you know, take this little bounce we've seen the last couple of days. Do something. You know, get reduced. Even if it's only 10%, move from 100% to 90 or 100% to 80. Do something, and then do something again next week, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, I don't think you should really be more than about 30 or 40% stocks maximum in the current environment. And even that allocation is going to be under pressure in the years ahead. There's a few other things I think that make sense to talk about here. Seems like we're all in agreement that long-term bonds, particularly high-quality bonds, are oversold and should benefit from, you know, any Fed reversal that comes. When we look at the chart of TLT, which is a proxy for long-term bonds, it seems technically oversold, very technically oversold. The bond market is building a lot of rate increases into the present. It's baked in the cake, so to speak. And we should see a pretty big bounce in long-term bonds, particularly high-quality U.S. bonds. So when I'm talking to somebody, if they have a component in there that's long-term, or even like a core bond fund that might say a government bond fund, I probably wouldn't sell that immediately. I would sell that if you feel overexposed there on a further bounce. I would really hone in on the equity part of the portfolio and move yourself to a lower equity allocation. Oftentimes that could be simply moving to a different target date fund. If you're in a target date fund, say 2040 or 2050, move to a target date fund 2025 or something like that. Or if you're not on a target date fund, simply consider moving out of some of the stocks that you've got into something else, like short-term bond fund, money market fund, or even a stable value fund. If you've got a stable value fund in there, That's a pretty good option as well. And lastly, you mentioned the brokerage window. Sometimes there's a brokerage window option where you can move a portion of the money into a brokerage account, and then you could buy things like physical metals. There's some really good physical backed metals funds out there. Gold mining shares are drastically undervalued, in our opinion. You could even buy things like long-term bonds that I mentioned earlier through ETFs that are available to you. Lastly, I feel like I should mention, since we're talking about 401ks, some people have the option to roll out of some portion of their 401ks through what's called an in-service withdrawal. You can take a look at your summary plan description. It's called an SPD, and maybe you can do an in-service withdrawal even while you're working to an outside IRA, and then you could manage that any way you want. You could even buy one-year treasury bills at almost 4%. If you'd like to do that. But no matter what you do, take some defensive action, because this bear market is probably just getting started. Down 20% is probably not where this bear market's going to bottom out.
All right. Really well said, Mike. And I just want to underscore the last two things you mentioned there, the brokerage window and then being able to roll part of it into an IRA. Both of those options let you escape from the very limited number of options that your 401k plan offers. And oftentimes, as Mike said, it's written there in your plan that you have these options. Your company usually just doesn't tell you about them. So you just have to call your plan administrator and just say, hey, are these options available to me? In most cases, they usually are. And if they are, well, then you can take whatever slice of your 401k qualifies for that. And then you can manage that almost any way you like in those other instruments. All right, this is a general question for anybody here that wants to answer it. Thomas is writing from the UK, says he wants to buy US treasuries and is asking if TLT would be the best way for him to buy them. So if anybody wants to weigh in on that, and maybe just very quickly talk about the pros and cons of an ETF like TLT versus owning the bonds directly.
I could take a shot at that. You know, I'm going to be reluctant to give specific investment advice to Thomas or any one person. That's really a point of specific advice that should be better off one-to-one based upon your situation. But if indeed your thesis is that U.S. Treasuries are going to be a good investment and you want to ask how to get access to them, TLT, first of all, is an ETF that has a basket of 20-plus year U.S. Treasury bonds. So if that's the asset class you're looking to get access to, it's a fine way to get access to the asset class. I would say an ETF like that is better for a trade than if, for example, you wanted to have exposure to the bonds, but have a longer term hold and in fact hold to maturity. It would be one scenario. I'm not recommending that, because I do think longer term bond rates eventually will go higher. But individual bonds are very easy to buy as well. You can buy individual U.S. Treasury bonds, and by doing so, you can control the maturity of those bonds. And if we did get a move higher in interest rates, you could at least guarantee yourself the stated yield to maturity on that bond by holding to maturity. It may be a long wait, but at least you can guarantee that yield to maturity return on investment, so long as the U.S. government doesn't go bankrupt, which I know today is not as unlikely of an event as maybe 20 years ago. But when you invest in a bond fund or an ETF like TLT, you don't have that ability to kind of manage the maturity and interest rate risk associated with that. But for trade, if you want access to that asset class, that's one of many very fine ways to do that. Very low in internal expense ratio and very liquid.
Okay, thanks. Just to your point, what owning the bonds directly does is it gives you the backstop of, hey, if this trade goes a different way than I thought, I can just hold it to maturity and at least I'm gonna get all my principal back and get paid along the way. Whereas if you're in TLT, it fluctuates just based upon the market value of the overall bond portfolio, right? Now, that said, there are pros and cons to both. All right. One thing to just let folks know too, just in case, you can buy bonds, you know, in your brokerage account, but you can also buy them directly from the U.S. government through Treasury Direct. We can talk more about that if people are interested. But if you buy an individual Treasury bond through Treasury Direct, let's say you buy the 30-year Treasury through there, and you decide at some point you'd like to sell it, you can actually transfer it to your brokerage account and sell it on the open market at any time as well. So you're not just stuck dealing with the Treasury itself inside of Treasury Direct. All right, Lance, I want to come to you with a question about one of our favorite topics, which is housing. And I want to kind of relate this to Jerome Powell's pretty stark language that he's used recently, where he said, hey, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get inflation under control, and that's going to result in pain for households, pain for businesses. And we've been talking about the mathematical impact that the rise in mortgage rates is going to have and looks like it's beginning to have on the housing market. And I just saw this chart the other day, which I'll put up here, which is house prices to median household income. And you'll see here that we recently got to a new high, higher even than the housing bubble back in 2006, 2007. And it looks like it's just beginning to nose over here. And so if you expect that this could mean revert, there's a long way to fall here, further than we fell, you know, in the correction from the previous housing bubble. So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts right now on the housing market and what that could do to the macro situation if indeed that chart I just showed starts mean reverting and you have this big negative wealth effect where people are, you know, basically feeling an awful lot poorer because their house just lost 20, 30, maybe even more percent?
Well, I mean, at some point you have to, you know, think about, you know, six plus percent, you know, mortgage rates, right? So first of all, what's not happening in the housing market, right? Nobody's refining their mortgage here, right? And you know, when people don't buy houses, they buy payments. So when the payment is too large for somebody to pay for, or it's outside their budget, and there was just an article out today talking how 60% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. So changes to your payment structure mean a lot, not just on your mortgages, but on car loans, auto loans, of whatever type, credit card loans, you know, all those rates are going up. So there's more and more disposable income getting extracted from the household. So now those payments matter, and they matter a lot. So given the big run-up in prices when interest rates were exceptionally low and we were doing 3% down mortgages, zero down mortgages, et cetera, to get people into houses they couldn't afford, you know, the backside consequence of this is that the longer that interest rates stay higher, the bigger the problem you're going to have. So now if interest rates all go back to 3% tomorrow on 30-year treasuries, then, you know, maybe the housing market stabilizes a bit. But the longer it stays elevated, the higher the risk that you're going to have a mean reversion. Back in 2008, at the peak of that bubble in your chart, right, when it first rolled over, everybody was saying the same thing. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's a little bit of a correction here. No big deal. It'll all be fine. Couple of years later, it's a very different story. But if you go back in history and look, you know, even on your chart going back to the 70s, every time you had big runs up in prices, you have a big reversion in price. And it happens every time. The only question is how far does it mean revert?
Got it. All right. So back to kind of Powell's pain prediction. What is it? Is the Scoville chart? Is that the chart where they measure the spiciness of a pepper, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the ones that are in the thousands, you know, just basically melt your lips off. Where are we in the Scoville chart of the pain that you think we're going to have to endure going through what we're going to be going through here? You know, scale of 1 to 10, or well, maybe a baseball analogy. Are we in the early innings still?
No, you're in mild green pepper territory. So, okay. I mean, you're just getting started. Look, housing prices are just starting to roll over. Remember, housing prices run a big lag. So it takes a lot, you know, I told you earlier, I sold my house back in July. That sale of that house has just showed up into the market in August when we finally closed and settled and everything did, right? So, you know, all that back lag effect is still coming through. You take a look at the Shiller price data, you know, that's a 3-month lag. You're looking at data that's 3 months ago, and that didn't really tell you a whole lot. It just tells you where things were 3 months ago. We already know that there's substantial damage going on in the housing market that hasn't shown up yet. I mean, you talk to a realtor, they're like, I ain't selling crap, right? So, you know, that's, you know, that just hasn't shown up yet. It will. And also we're seeing the same thing in the multifamily. Multifamily has record inventory going on right now, and rents are starting to come down. So that drop in rental rates combined with a drop in housing prices, that all feeds into homeowners equivalent rent, which is going to start to show up. And again, given the very large percentage of what homeowners equivalent rent is the CPI calculation. And now that we're about to start and starting in November, December, January, February, we're going to start having year over year comparisons of very big jumps in inflation. So that potential here for a fairly sharp drop in inflation coming over the next several months is becoming much more elevated.
Right. And specifically when you're saying inflation, you're talking about as measured by the CPI.
There. Correct. Because again, that's where that home, that that's where homeowners equivalent rent makes up like 40% of the index.
Yeah. And I am, this weekend ended up basically spending the weekend on Twitter. And it was pretty fascinating. And folks, if you're interested, I'll put my Twitter handle down there in the live chat. It's at Menlo Bear. But if you're curious, you should go back and read this. I basically asked of my followers, hey, anybody who's involved in real estate, just give us a boots on the ground assessment of what you're seeing right now. And it was amazing. You know, sort of expected that people were going to say, yeah, we're beginning to see the market cool off. But in 90%+ of the responses, and these were people from all over the US and certain other international markets, it was almost all, my God, like this thing has just iced up. You know, transaction volumes have stopped. The price corrections are coming in. You know, a couple of markets where that really quite hadn't hit yet, but they definitely seen cooling. Seemed like the luxury higher end markets in a couple places like Bozeman, Montana were still holding up, but almost everywhere else, I mean, it was grim. And a lot of these were like, I've been in, you know, a mortgage lender for 30 years and you know, I've almost never seen it this, you know, quiet and that type of stuff. And to your point, Lance, we're still just at the mild, you know, green, maybe even the black pepper you put on your, over your food mildness, right? So
yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see what comes down. All right, New Harbor guys, Mike, why don't we start with you? Feel free to add anything onto that. But there's a question asked here. I can't find it in the stream because there's so many comments now. But it was asked by Bruce Chavers, who said, what's the upside for stocks in 2023? I got to tell you, given everything we've just talked about, it's hard to think of the upside case for stocks and what may be happening next year, but that's just one man's opinion. What do you guys think?
Well, that's a difficult question because you know, anything's possible, including technically unlimited upside. There's people out there, including the ones that have been on your program, Adam, that have predicted melt ups, and that could happen. You know, there's you know, David Hunter has been on the program, said that we could get a melt up to 6,000 on the S&P. I don't really like to encourage thinking about that possibility because it's actually hard to play for that possibility in a risk controlled way, unless you use options or something like that. But, you know, as we said here before, multiple times today, valuations just barely back to previous bubble peaks. There's no case to play the long side. There's no case to jump on the long side, hoping for a melt up based on any of that stuff. The only real reason to do that would be game theorizing the Fed, which is a dangerous game because you got to think about what is your exit plan, you know, if you're wrong or if we roll over right from here, which I think is very likely. So I don't see a lot of upside. I can never say never, but I personally don't see upside unless we have much more pressure in the S&P first. I think if we get a real washout here down to the low 3000s, even the high 2000s on the S&P, I think there could be a tradable bounce over the next quarter or two. But I personally don't see a lot of upside nor an easy way to play it from these levels.
Okay. I mean, I guess something Lance mentioned earlier, I mean, I guess if we had just a massive policy response to something, not just monetary stimulus, but a you know, another big massive fiscal stimulus package. Maybe that could push stuff up. But again, you know, we'd have to be in some sort of national emergency akin to a global pandemic, which is not something we really all want to be rooting for here.
Well, look, real quick before you jump off of this, you know, you got to be careful. You know, look, to whoever asked the question, making a prediction more than 3 days out is a fool's game, right? So just, you know, trying to even predict what's going to happen next year is a wild ass guess at best. The reality is that bear markets last 12 to 18 months historically. The last 6 months of that 12 to 18 month period are the worst months, right? So bear markets end badly all the time. You know, there's a potential case to be made, and there's people making this case right now from Morgan Stanley to others that, you know, we'll set the lows for the market this October, right? And then we'll have, you know, better outcomes in 2023. This is all going to be a function of earnings at the end of the day. And the question is whether or not we're corrected enough to absorb the overvaluation in the markets. And I, you know, personally, I don't think they've corrected enough yet. But if corporate profit margins stay high and earnings start to come back and economic activity starts to recover, then, you know, stocks are going to do better. So what you have to pay attention to is don't worry about what markets are going to do next year. Pay attention to what the markets are doing now. Do your fundamental analysis. Look at what you're trying to find. And even in today's market, there are opportunities to put capital to work. Even on the equity side, there's opportunity. There's stocks that have been blown out 70, 80, 90%. A good example is Snowflake, which is a company that does cloud-based data management and software. But that stock is up 70% from its lows back in May of this year. It's been forming a really steady pattern of higher lows and higher highs. Very bullish trend for the markets coming off very beaten up distress levels. I'm not saying go buy that stock. What I'm saying is there are opportunities that exist in this market today where you'll be able to make money regardless of what the rest of the market is doing. So don't get wrapped up in this whole big bear market thesis, the world's coming to an end. Look for the opportunities to put capital to work and make money. That's what our job is.
Right, right. And also too, and I should have specified this earlier, let's say we're all correct, we are in a bear market, it will be over at some point in time, right? And it could end in 2023, and who knows, it could end in the first quarter, it could end in the fourth, but at some point, you know, if it does, and we've talked about kind of the classic arc where it grinds down, and then everybody capitulates, and you get this like 25% washout, and then, you know, the bottom's in, and things start rebuilding. Well, that could happen in Q1. And so if we see a big washout like that and feel like, okay, you know, odds are that this thing has been played out, yeah, that may be a great time to start putting capital to work, to your point.
And look, and the other side of this, and we've had this conversation before, Adam, is that, you know, I've got clients coming into my office that have been out of the market since 2009, right? You know, they got out at the bottom of the bear market in 2008, have never come back into the markets because it was always, well, the crash is still coming, we're not done yet. And then the market started recovering and rallying. And then they're like, well, now it's overbought and it's overvalued, so I got to wait for a pullback. But then it never pulled back enough because, you know, valuations were high and we actually never reverted those valuations. So they've been out for 9 years, right? 10 years, 11 years, 12 years. And now they're just trying to figure out how to get back into the markets here at this level. And that's the risk you run, right? You know, getting involved or entrenched into one thesis, whether it's a bear market or a bull market or whatever it is. The problem is that, you know, it's like, oh, the bear market's going to come. It's going to stay going. It's, you know, we got more to go to the downside. And you kind of, you know, stop paying attention to the other stuff that's going on in the world. What happens is that you'll wind up missing the bottom of the market. You'll miss the run up in the markets. By the time you realize it's time to get back in, you've already given up a big chunk of your gains. I wrote an article on our website at realinvestmentadvice.com talking about this, that you know, trying to miss a bear market can be more damaging than actually going through the bear market itself.
Yeah, and that's the classic Peter Lynch, right? He said that there's been more money lost anticipating the next big market correction than was actually lost in it, right? Because of people just sitting on the sidelines. All good points. So I hate to do this, folks. We got to wrap up here. I got to keep my commitment to my daughter to get her to her driver's test. Next video I shoot with you guys, I'll let everybody know how it went. My money's on her though. She's a pretty conscientious kid. But you know, I do think it's fair to say, guys, out of, you know, everything we've talked about here, that this is a particularly challenging and uncertain time, and the risks seem to be continually getting dialed up here. And what happened in the UK, you know, is a great example of that, right? So, kind of where I'm going with this is, I'm going to give each of you guys just a quick moment to give any parting advice or counsel to viewers that you want. But you know, the reason why I've created Wealthion and I have you guys on here to do these live events like this, is this is a particularly hard time to go it alone, especially if you're not like a highly experienced investor. And I think most people watching are regular people who are just trying to figure out how to navigate this and not get shipwrecked, you know, through whatever might be coming and come out okay on the other side. I think most people probably don't even want to be responsible for managing their money here. They're just having a tough time finding, you know, good stewards that they feel they can trust to help them do this. So obviously that's the business you're in, is being kind of the quarterback, the coach, the navigator for folks here. You do it every day with the clients you have. What would your advice be to folks watching here who are in that mindset of like, I just don't want to get destroyed by what's coming? John, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, well, I would remind, as I'm sure we all do when we talk to real people, real clients, to bring it back to their own situation. In this environment, the three of us kind of generally agree about the risk-reward equation, you know, being heavily weighted towards likely further downside and sizable at that. You know, most people's biggest risk isn't missing out on a bounce in the market or a new high over the next 12 months. Their biggest likely risk is unwittingly suffering a big decline that they need a miraculous recovery to dig out of. You know, the economics of loss are unforgiving. You lose 10%, that's pretty modest. You only need 11% to get back to even. If your portfolio drops 40 or 50%, a 50% decline requires 100% subsequent return to get back to even. So keeping downside on the low side and not trying to pick up pennies in front of the steamroller. You know, any bounces that may likely happen, we've all kind of shared our views. We think they're likely to yield to new lows ahead. And it's just not worth it for most folks to try to skim that cream, because the consequences of being wrong can far outweigh the benefit of being right.
Well said. Mike, anything to add to that?
Just don't be afraid to take some action. We've just, you know, sat through the largest bull market of our lifetimes the last 12 years or so. And so even with this recent pullback, most people are still sitting on very good gains. So if you feel overexposed, take a little action and then a little more next week, next month, or whatever. Bear markets, one like the one that we think we're in, are stealthy, and they'll give you countless opportunities to, you know, to think the bottom is in and that it's back to the same old normal. But you know, we think the paradigm has shifted. Valuations are, again, still high, and things are different now in the sense that interest rates are much higher than they were a year ago. And there are alternatives where you can park money and get a good yield. So, you know, don't be afraid of picking, don't be afraid of not keep picking the top. Don't be afraid of taking action, and you know, don't panic. You know, the sky isn't falling, but the paradigm has likely changed. So that's it. Thanks.
Okay, great. And Lance, I know you're usually reticent to say anything, but do you have any final words there?
Look, what both Mike and John said are just right. Is right, is that, you know, look, this rally, we're going to have a rally here most likely. Markets are extremely oversold. Use that rally to raise some cash, rebalance risk. If you haven't liked your return so far this year, means you've got too much equity risk, take some. There's another side to this, though. You're right. And you know, if you're not sure what to do, or this market's really just weighing on you, and it's just, you know, it's really kind of affecting your lifestyle, there's nothing wrong with just getting out, right? Just go park it in money market right now. Money market's yielding 2% in a lot of cases. You don't have to invest. Nobody said you have to invest anything, right? And eventually the market will bottom and it'll start to rally. And look, you're going to miss the bottom. You're going to miss whatever opportunity it is. That's okay too. There's nothing wrong with that. And then when you feel better about the environment, the world, et cetera, then you get back to work. But that's, you know, that's why you if you can't do it yourself, go hire an advisor. It's worth the fee you'll pay, because they take the brunt of having to deal with making those decisions of trying to get in and doing the research and the analysis. But if you want to manage your money yourself, that's awesome. Nothing wrong with that. Find you a good set of tools, find you a good set of technical indicators to follow, or if that doesn't work for you and it's just too much, just cash is fine. You know, there's again, you know, we make this big deal like you have to be invested in the markets. You don't. Saving money, and just saving money, you can build a lot of wealth just by saving money and putting away. Investing helps, but it's not a requirement.
All right. Very well said. all of you guys. Folks, look, I hate to wrap it up here. Got to go, though. Got to go do the driving test thing. Couple quick things in parting. We're continuing to use this new format here, the StreamYard software. I think it works well. I think people really like this live interactive format. But do me a favor, just let us know in the comment section if indeed you like it, if you think we should continue doing it. Secondly, I put a link here at the bottom of the screen. I tried to get through as many questions here as I could. Obviously, there were way more questions than we had time for. So if you'd like to get your questions that remain unasked or unanswered, answered by Lance, John, or Mike directly, you can just schedule a free consultation with them. Just go to wealthion.com, fill out the form, and you can be connected directly with them and ask your questions directly of these gentlemen. If you guys want to continue to see us do these things, these live events, this monthly, weekly Ask Anything Q&A, just do me a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button below. And then if you have yet to subscribe to this channel, just click on the red subscribe button below as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Lance, John, Mike, guys, thank you so much again for giving us an hour of your time to help people out here like this. And everybody else, thanks so much for taking the time to watch. Take care, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow, where we will be releasing our first video of our interview with Bill Fleckenstein. And it's a good one. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you, Adam. Everyone.